Rabbi Moshe Gnuth, thank you very much for coming on the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, and it was very nice having you come and teach a class on Shabbos morning. It was over a month or so now, and had my nice friends, you know, introduce me to you and all that you're involved with, being the secretary for Rabbi Ginsburg. And, you know, when I was doing a little bit of research and listening to your classes on YouTube, you also have, you know, a lot of a wonderful story and ability to express Hasidus. So I wanted to have you on and to learn and to share ideas.
My pleasure to be here.
So I'd love to start off by hearing a little bit about your background and what brought you to today.
Okay. Short version is that I was born in Eretz Yisrael. And my parents moved to the United States when I was starting high school. I went to a public high school, actually, in America. Though I had been from my whole life, that was what they wanted me to do. And when I finished high school, I went to Johns Hopkins. After that, I went back to Eretz Yisrael and started learning in a yeshiva, specifically Merkaz Zarav. I was a Nit Yarmulke back then. And after about a year, I went to the army, finished the army, and then met up with a very capable Talmud Chacham, who I learned with for 3 years. And then I met Rabbi Ginsburg. And from then on, it was I've been with him. A little bit later, after meeting Rabbi Ginsburg, about half a year later, I met Rabbi Steinsaltz. And
wow.
Because I lived in Yerushalayim, so I had an ongoing, Baruch Hashem, an ongoing relationship with him for about 15 years. The last 10 years of his life, I was less and less connected. There are all kinds of reasons for that. And so Baruch Hashem, that was, that in short is the story.
How did you meet Rabbi Ginsburg? And was that your first introduction to more of the Kabbalistic aspect of and Hasidic aspect of Judaism?
So I had been fortunate enough to have a cousin growing up who was a big Talmud of Mordechai Atiyah. He was one of the more well-known teachers of Kabbalah. I wouldn't say that he's a Kabbalist, he's a teacher of Kabbalah. Very rational, very well-grounded. He teaches in Yerushalayim. He has a yeshiva here. His cousin was about the same age as Rav Mordechai is. And from a very early age, I think age 13 or 14, I was very connected to him. And I used to study with him quite a bit. So I was introduced quite early to Kabbalah and to Kabbalistic ideas, to the Zohar and to learning the Zohar, but mostly to learning the Arizal. By the Sfardim, it's Shara Kavanot, not so much Priyetz Chaim as it is by the Ashkenazim. And so by the time I had come back for yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, I had been learning with him for quite a while. So when I started hearing about Hasidus, I started picking up on around when I was 16, 17, during the summers when I used to come to Eretz Yisrael. I had another cousin who was very into Hasidus. Back then, Hasidus and Chabad were not connected in my mind. I didn't even think of them as being related in any way. Chabad was a movement. Chabad was some kind of, we want Mashiach now. And because I did grow up in the 80s in the United States. Mm. And Chabad was outreach. I didn't connect it with the teachings of Chabad. I didn't know there was such a thing even. What I did know as I started to learn more Hasidus was I knew who Reb Tzadok was. I knew who Mashilach was. I knew the Sfas Emes. I didn't yet even know that there was anything from the Baal Shem Tov. I mean, I knew there was a Baal Shem Tov. I didn't know there was Keter Shem Tov, Shavas or Rivash. All these other works, certainly not the Magid, I wasn't aware of.
Wow. So when you said movement, you really meant like it was just a, like not like it, like you said, it was kind of something separate than an ideology. Social movement.
And I think that, by the way, till today, I think that that's a very fair assessment of what Chabad is since the Rebbe. It's sort of like when waters are moving, they don't stand, so they don't collect. And people, the Rebbe got everyone to move. So the learning was not the thing that was being advertised. What was really being advertised was the movement, was that we're bringing people closer back to Yiddishkeit and so on. Mm-hmm. In any case, so I had known about these two topics separately, and from the little bit that I learned in these other Polish Hasidus, let's call it, I was aware of the connection to Kabbalah, but I couldn't exactly at that age, I couldn't tell you what the relationship was. I knew there was some kind of relationship, but it wasn't clear. Mm-hmm. It was clear to me, and this was always true, that because I spent time in Rav Kook's yeshiva in Merkaz Harav, it was clear to me that that the language that he had chosen was putting me off, because he wasn't using the Kabbalistic language. It was clear to me already that you had to use Kabbalistic language in order to, as it were, to join the conversation. The moment you pick your own language, theology, let's call it our spiritual system. And Rav Kook chose to, like the Maharal, he chose to.
Was your intention, so to speak, to look for, just like, was our purpose?
Yes, of course, yeah. It was on purpose. He was trying to open the spiritual side of Yiddishkeit up to people who couldn't speak Kabbalistic lingo.
Yeah.
And it's true. When it comes to Kabbalah, it's not even like the Talmud. The Talmud has its problems with Aramaic. But you can, in the end, a smart person can figure it out. When it comes to the Zohar, when it comes to the Arizal, if you don't have some kind of somebody offering you translation services, not of the language but of the ideas, it's almost impregnable. You can't get through it. So there was a good reason for it. In any case, when I first heard Rav Ginsburg was from tapes, and I remember the first series that I heard, and that was the first time that I heard this connection between serious Kabbalistic knowledge and very deep Hasidus. The Hasidus I right away recognized, because I already understood the Hasidus was a language of the soul, language of the psyche. And that was immediately apparent in his teachings. And the Kabbalah dumbfounded me, because I had to say that I know all these concepts he's talking about, but I've never heard them structured this way, explained this way. That was a complete revelation to me. Like, I couldn't even begin to imagine how did he do this? Like, what's going on here? Because as structured as Kabbalists are, they a lot of times do get lost because of the complexity of the material. And here I was hearing something that was very, very structured, very clear. And I hadn't heard anything that in that way ever before, as well as, I think more importantly, an actual explanation of what the concepts meant in day-to-day life, which I was always missing.
So he was able to break it all down into... That's so. Did he also introduce you to different, like, to learn? Like, what did he learn with you? How did you, you know, you said you,
well,
built the relationship and you started working with it. But maybe you can share some of you main things that he taught you, and like how to bring it down, but at the same time, Hasidus kind of brings it down for us as well.
Yes, without a doubt. I mean, the Rebbeim were, as we would say, very accomplished Kabbalists,
mm-hmm.
Teachers of Kabbalah, not Kabbalists, but people who knew Kabbalah really well. Yet you don't always feel that that's their main topic. You feel that they're so well-versed that it's almost like they could get off with they could tell you that it is, and you wouldn't know the difference.
Yeah.
There was one period of time that I could say that I learned with him.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say learned with him, I was thinking of learning with someone who's like chavrusa, And there was only one period in my work with him that it was like teaching him teaching me or us doing something together that could be called a chavrusa. And that was when we did mathematics together. And he taught me how he sees mathematics. And we spent about a year on that, meeting at least once a week, sometimes twice a week. And you have to understand, a meeting with him is usually 8, 9 hours. Like, and there's no break in the middle either. He's unstoppable. Like, once he starts with Torah, he doesn't, it's like he's not in this world. And it just, and you get sort of, you know, drawn into it. And you also, you don't feel time going by. Wow. But most of the years I did work with him one-on-one, but it was work. It was more him dictating, me writing down, and then rewriting while he waited sometimes, or not. Sometimes he would dictate like 2-3 pages. He dictated stuff off the top of his head. He wouldn't have notes or anything. And then I'd spend then he'd go off and continue his work. And I'd spend a couple of hours trying to edit it and trying to restate it in a language that might be more accessible. Mm-hmm. But all my learning with him has always been through the classes, like everyone else. I just sit in the classes. Mm-hmm. And what I found to be very important for me is that I always transcribe his classes, meaning it took me time. In the beginning, I was doing it with handwriting and trying to, I have all kinds, a few dozen notebooks full of handwritten notes from his classes. But in the later years, from about 2007, we started working with laptops. So we just started transcribing word for word almost. And that's been very instrumental for me for understanding what he's saying.
Because I know you also have a practice as a psychologist, correct?
I'm not a psychologist. I would like to think of myself as a mashpia, not as a psychologist.
Even nicer in some ways. So then, well, you learn a lot of.
Yes.
Aware of what the modern, yeah. So did, were there, and we're beginning, you know, more and more seeing a lot of the correlation between modern day psychology and the tools, you know, techniques. What were some that you learned from, or were there some tools that you learned from him, like not just breaking down the Kabbalah into practical day to day, but, you know, processing, let's say, emotions, getting through challenges in one's life, or, you know, setting intentions, praying.
I would say that first, an introduction, that there are two areas in which Rav Ginzburg is truly an expert.
Mm-hmm.
One is, and they're both intuitive. He's had training in mathematics, but he's an intuitive mathematician, meaning he looks at a problem, a mathematical problem, the way a mathematician will. He's not drawing on his schooling. He's drawing on what flows out of him, and it's pure math. It's wonderful to watch it. The other area is psychology. Now you could say Hasidus, say psychology. He has a very, very deep intuition, very deep, about what constitutes psychological health. Very deep, and he's worked on himself extensively. A lot of times I say some of the stuff that we learn from him now, 60 years later, is almost him writing what worked for him. But that's also where his critique comes. And his critique of Hasidus today is that Hasidus has not lived up to its promise. And the true promise of Hasidus was to bring Torah to the psyche. Mm. And in the sense of translating, that's what Hasidus does. It translates whatever we had before from Chazal, from Kabbalah, from whatever it was, translating it into the language of psychology. Now, again, this is a loaded word, because the moment I say psychology, one thinks of what goes on in an academic setting. But we really mean, and then we say it in Hebrew, it sounds different, it's Torah Nefesh. It's a Torah of the Nefesh. Psyche literally means Nefesh. That's what it means. That's what they called it in Greek. anima in Latin, but it means the psyche. So psychology is the correct word. It's just that today it's been taken by the academic world. So we call it Torat HaNefesh. And it's not just that he's given over the years techniques or ideas about what to do or translated things. I believe that what he's done is he's fulfilled the promise of Chassidus.
Nice.
He's taken Chassidus and he's made it into something that when you study the way that we present it after these many years of his involvement in it, you get a coherent picture of what it means to help someone psychologically and what it means to work on your own psychology also, to understand, I mean, the basic understanding of what are the character traits that need to be developed. Simple thing. I mean, if you go to Musar, you'll get a whole list of what you need to develop. Everybody knows you should be bittul. What exactly does bittul mean? A lot of people think it means not being, but that's not bittul. It is one extreme form of bittul, but bittul usually means something entirely different, which means to actually come into the world, not to leave the world. Bittul is actually a downward force. It forces the spirit back into the world because I am bittul to the commandments. I am bittul to my mission in life. I am bittul to something that I need to do. And then there's the counterpart, which is shiflus, which we translate as lowliness, which is a lot of people hear loneliness. It's not about being lonely, it's about being lowly. But it's such a loaded word again, because people think that to be lowly is to be degraded, it's to be self-deprecating.
Mm-hmm.
It's none of these things. It's just to be able to come to a true awareness of my issues, of my problems, and to understand that I by myself can't solve them, that I need Hashem for that. And in many ways, everything that's happening is, how do I bring Hashem more into the picture and draw myself more to the side and be able to base my psyche not on my own prowess, but rather on Hashem's involvement in me, and not just involvement, but everything. So
could you say that bittul is like a flow state?
Not necessarily, no. Flow state, there are flow states. I know that a lot of people, we'll talk about maybe about positive psychology in a moment, but the real issue here is, I'll say it like this, that the way I see it today is that Freud took us for a ride, and he took the whole world for a ride. And the ride was that somehow we're going to build a psychology that can heal people from their illnesses. And so everything becomes about illness, and so you have to turn depression into an illness, because otherwise it doesn't really fit into psychology and so on. But the truth is, it's very, very difficult, if at all possible, to heal something in the mind and in the psyche. It's very, very difficult, if at all. And really what usually heals is Hashem. It's just time going by. And the question is, what are you going to do in the meantime? Psychology, the way I think Chassidus sees it, is more about building character. It's more about building resilience. It's about preparing a person and giving them the tools to be able to come to terms with their shortcomings. Not to try to necessarily get rid of them, because it's very hard to get rid of them, but rather to use them to his advantage. So we're afraid of admitting that we have these problems, but they're actually some of our greatest assets, because these problems give a person lowliness, because they put us in front of Hashem and say, like David says, "Vayidi shafal beinai," I'm lowly in my own eyes. Why? Because I know what my problems are. I know exactly what they are. I need you, Hashem, all the time. That state of dependence is something that is maybe the most important thing that a Hasidic psychologist could teach to anyone.
That's that the shiftless you're talking about.
Shiftless.
So like not recognizing my weaknesses is actually in the positive sense that I only have God to turn to.
Right.
To help
because
me out.
That is the that is the first step in any healing process. And again, a healing process is not necessarily what I'm going to do in therapy. It's something that's going to happen through life, but it's sort of like saying, we say this every Shabbos in Nishmas Kol Chai, Cholaim Ra'im V'Ne'emanim. What it means is that the illnesses that we have are faithful. And they ask, why are they faithful? Because they're faithful to Hashem. Hashem sends them in such a way that they're meant to help us. And the moment that we've learned what we can from them, they go away anyway. They disappear anyway. But that's not the issue. The issue is, what am I doing with it now? How is this? So if it's only putting me down, that wasn't the point. The point is to get to a place where these things bring me closer to Hashem. So that's the really the first stage. And just to be able to, when I teach this to anyone, I'll just give you a small anecdote. It's a man who's been married for about 10 years. He can't stand his wife's criticism of him. And he's right. A woman should not criticize her husband. It's a thing that kills marriages. And even if he needs to be criticized, there's a way to do it, and it should be done very seldomly. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't stand it, and there's a lot of it in their home, and he doesn't, and he feels that he's constantly under attack, which he is. So what does he do with that? And this is an illness, meaning illnesses are not always organic to the person. Sometimes they're in the environment around him. So there's something that he's carrying now. What is he carrying? He's carrying his wife's criticism. What does he do with that? So one way you can deal with it is, this is just arrows at his ego, and it's just killing him every time that he hears it, and there's no good relationship between them. The other option is to learn how to say thank you for each one of these criticisms. Mm-hmm. Why? Because even though she's doing it in the incorrect way, she's not helping their marriage at all, but she's doing what Hashem wants her to do. It's like the Alter Rebbe, when he heard his wife, he used to say that I'm supposed to limshol bach. Limshol bach means to understand you as a metaphor for what Hashem is saying to me. A mashal. What you're saying to me is a mashal for what Hashem wants from me.
That's nice. Where did he say that? Where is that?
He says that. Who limshol bach means that you should listen to your wife and understand what she's saying as the words of Hashem in a mashal. She's saying it how she's saying it. So the moment that you understand that, the moment he understood this, suddenly he's having a conversation, not with her, he's having a conversation with his, with Hashem. Now, it's still, I'm saying that also needs to be taken care of, but it's an illness that's striking you all the time. And suddenly you say, wait a minute, this is not just striking me for no reason. And why is it striking me? Because Hashem wants me to turn to him. Mm-hmm. Because I'm ignoring Hashem. All these things happen to us because we're ignoring Hashem. Mm-hmm. We're not having the conversation we're supposed to have. So the moment that you think of it in those terms, and not as something that's just bugging me or troubling me or making my life difficult for no reason, I want to get rid of it. And God willing, you will get rid of it. But it's there to encourage a relationship with Hashem. So the moment that that's understood and the person turns back to Hashem, everything changes. The whole interpretation of the whole situation changes. I'm not saying that everyone's going to jump up for joy every time that they're in pain or suffering. That doesn't normally happen, but it gives context, it gives meaning. And the moment that there's context and meaning, people can carry many, many things, but not just carry them in the sense of a burden, but carry them in the sense of learning from them, and things change after that.
Is it specifically just the wife or the relationships? Because we learned that the external world is a reflection of the internal. So I would think that, you know, anybody, and I remember learning from a psychologist, let's say she would use the just an example that, if somebody does something that bothers me, it's not them. I'm the one with the button that they're pushing. But I'm not, you know, married yet, God willing, soon. But, you know, that's from my father. That's from a person I just walk across the street and says something and I happen to hear it, you know. But maybe it's something deeper when it comes from the wife. Maybe that's what the Alter Rebbe is emphasizing.
Well, it's definitely much more intense. When you treat the outside world the way that you're describing, that many times is borderline egomaniacism.
Interesting.
Because not everything is about you. There are things that are about other people. They have nothing to do with you. Now, why Hashem is showing it to you, so there's an important sicha from the Rebbe about Shem Cham and Yafis and what they did with the covering their father, and what we learned from that about the Baal Shem Tov's famous saying that if you see something, it's something about sign. You. And the Rebbe changes it very much from the, let's call it the intuitive understanding that people had of this Torah from the Baal Shem Tov. It doesn't necessarily mean you need to fix something in you. He changes it to be that when you have something to do about it, meaning you see some iniquity, you see something wrong, and you can do something about it, then it's calling out to you. But it's not necessarily describing anything about you. It would be the same thing as, I don't know if people still listen to the radio, but somebody listens to the radio and they said, oh, I should go down to the store to buy something on a sale. So I need to go do that. That's not how the world works. So not everything that's happening in the world is about me. It's not necessarily related to me. Even if somebody is addressing me directly, it doesn't always mean that. You have to be careful about that. Like, you have to take that with a grain of salt and make sure that it's not coming out of a aggrandized sense of ego. But when it comes to my wife, I can't run away from it. It's definitely about our relationship. I mean, that's the, in a certain sense, when a woman is willing to marry someone, she's willing to do the work with him, which is usually not easy, because the people that suffer from ego more than others is usually the men. Now, for someone to be willing to take me as a project and to spend her life with me and address my problems and live with them, so it's about me. I need to do something about it.
How would somebody become aware themselves of that egomaniacism? Let's say, like, you know, I think I'll admit sometimes I would, maybe I took it to the extreme where, you know, if I heard something, I would at least run it by and question and see, like, how is this message? You know, it was actually funny. I was walking back the other day, just from 770 to the yeshiva. And there was this woman, she was like clearly kind of, not Jewish woman, just clearly, you know, frustrated about something. And she was talking on the phone and she's like, I don't even think the Jews know what Judaism is. And I walked by and there was a guy a little in front of me and I was like, you know, I think she has a point. Sometimes we have a you know, a limited understanding of what's really Judaism about. And then I thought about it about myself, like, what, where am I misunderstanding, you know, what Judaism really is?
It's true. I definitely agree with her. certainly we have a problem with at least, you know, 70% maybe of the Jewish people that don't know anything about mitzvot, that don't know anything about our obligations. What it's about is, it's infinitely deep. So I don't know if anybody knows exactly what it's about.
Yeah.
Because at the end, it's about Hashem. And in that sense, there is no end to it. But getting back to the issue, I sort of start from the, whoever comes to me and talks to me, I start from the premise that everybody is an egomaniac. Not in the clinical sense, but I mean it in the day-to-day life sense, that we all live our lives seeing ourselves as a center of the universe. And that is where all the problems start from, all the problems.
Yeah.
And any chip you can make into that picture, anything you can chip away at that picture is automatically going to help the person. Rabbi Isaac of Homil, who was one of the famous Talmidim of the Alter Rebbe, and from him we know a lot of things of the Alter Rebbe that weren't written down by others. He writes in one place that he was living in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, and they already started having merry-go-rounds. They ran on steam, or I don't know on what. Steam was being used in industry since 1760. So these were already like common things even in Russia. Mm-hmm. And he describes his experience of getting on one. And he said, well, this is a way that I can teach anyone what it means to suddenly not be the center of the universe. Because the moment that you get on the merry-go-round, you suddenly lose your balance because the center is now moved into the center of the merry-go-round. You're just spinning around. The Rijiner was once told that the scientists now say, called natural philosophers back then, that it's not the earth in the center of the universe, it's the sun. And they say that he thought for a few minutes, and then he said, because the tzaddikim want it that way now. That's how he said. What did he mean? He meant that if you continue to think that you're the center of the universe, it's not healthy anymore. This was tolerable for people hundreds of years ago, but modern people need to understand that they're not the center of the universe. You're not the center of the universe in the sense of shiflus, and you're not the center of the universe in the sense of what I called before degrading you or self-deprecation, which was what science does. Science relegates you to the last thing that's important in the universe, just the dust of the cosmos or whatever it is. And says you have no bit, what you do doesn't matter at all. That's denigrating the human being. What needs to be put in check and what needs to be taken out of the center is the sense of ego, the self, sense of self-importance. Now we have a problem because we look out of here. And when I look out of here, it seems to me that what's behind my eyes is the center of the universe. I don't have any other perspective, physical perspective on the world. First of all, that's why it's so important to be able to close one's eyes and to do isbonenus, because one of the things that isbonenus allows you to do is to detach from that picture, that perspective. But another good thing to do, which is not isbonenus per se, but it's a very simple a simple exercise that anyone can do, is look into a mirror, even though we're men, we're not supposed to look into a mirror. So look into a mirror anyway, especially when there's other people around. If you could, women have this all the time, so they don't even worry about this. But if you think about like a ballet studio, and they have these big mirrors on the walls, and everybody's dancing in front of the mirror. When you look at yourself in the mirror, you don't identify with yourself. You don't identify with your image in the mirror. That's a very important step in being able to detach from this primacy of the ego and beginning to understand that I'm just another thing here in the world. I'm just another thing. It's true that I have my responsibilities about this thing, but I'm just another thing. And when you can begin to, when you can begin to see this, from the perspective that the world is not about me, you begin to understand that the world is about Hashem. That at the center of the universe really is not the sun or Alpha Centauri or whatever constellation you want to put there. What's at the center and what we're all orbiting and what we're all moving around is Hashem.
Very nice.
The moment that you begin to understand that the Hashem is the center, you begin to understand what your role is, and you begin to understand why people tell you things and why and they're not necessarily even telling you something. They're just passing by, like maybe two ships in the night, but they're passing by because they're also orbiting Hashem. They also have their own lives that are orbiting Hashem.
So is it only from that place then that we can say Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, that man was created, or that the world was created for me?
So this is a beautiful thing from Rav Ginsburg. He usually has the Aleph Bet Gimel of mental health. So the Aleph is Einod Mivado. First of all, there's only Hashem. If there's only Hashem, then you can say Bishvili Nivra Olam. Meaning the Einod Mivado is saying he's the center of the universe. He is the universe. He is everything. The moment I say that, then I also have a mission. I also have something that I was created for. And the world is here to serve me in fulfilling that mission. Then it's Bishvili Nivra Olam. But then the test of whether I've done this correctly is the Gimel, whether I can say about everything Gamzu Latova. If I can say that everything is Gamzu Latova, I got the idea. I'm working right.
Nice. So I think an interesting transition, and thank you for that. That was very nice. Is a lot of nowadays in popular psychology and just there's the whole healing work, so to speak. There's breath work, there's meditation. We talked about Hezbollah, and I didn't get a chance yet to share with you, but I had, a lot of experience at meditation retreats, and that I felt practicing Hezbollah and meditation helped me re-explore Hasidus and Judaism to want to practice and Torah and mitzvahs. But I'll say that seems some people get into the healing work, whether they grew up, let's just say religious or observant or not, and it seems like it some takes them away from it, whereas some maybe get more into it. What, like I said, regardless of how they grew up, what do you have, or does Rav Ginsburg have perhaps a insight why, like it seems like those healing tools are supposed to help with that and lead to closer connection with God, and such as learning Torah and mitzvahs. But some people, and they seem to be healing very well, but not involved with Torah and mitzvahs.
Meditation, and I assume you by meditation you don't mean Hezbollah, even though you use
No,
that
I do. I do.
translation. But the meditations that are offered in the world doesn't necessarily even have to be Eastern meditation. It could be all types. there's two different purposes to what people call meditation today, and one of them is what the Rebbe actually advocated for, which is to break yourself out of the cycle of anxiety and stress. And that's supposed to calm you down. And there are good things. They're decent. A lot of people, for some reason, associate it with mindfulness. I'm not 100% sure that that's what the Rebbe meant. But in any case, there are forms of meditation that are like meant to help the nervous system. Let's say it that way. Yeah, especially the vagus nerve, which is probably one of the biggest problems, or not problems, but even a hack that we can get through. And to that purpose, you could also use breathing techniques and whatever else. Meditation in the classic sense, especially if you go back to the French, and Descartes wrote his book, called it Meditation, which means meditations. It means thought. And any meditation that requires you to think of something is already something else. That's not about alleviating symptoms in the nervous system. That's already a cerebral type of exercise. And the question is, what are you using your mind for? Most, if not all, of these techniques can be summarized in a pasuk from Mishlei. It's a pasuk that appears many times in Chassidus, and I'll say it in Israeli Hebrew: Lo yachfotz ksil b'tivuna ki im b'itgalut libo. That the fool does not seek understanding, comprehension. What he seeks is to uncover his heart. He wants to reveal his heart. And when what Proverbs means is that a person is seeking himself. Sort of like the issue that we have with the Delphic statement over the it says that over the temple in Delphi, it said, "Know thyself." Know yourself. Whereas King David says to his son, "Da'et Elokei Avicha," know the God of your father. And again, it goes back to the question of who and what are you trying to know? Are you trying to know Hashem, or are you trying to know yourself?
Isn't
Now,
yeah, sorry.
they're mutually exclusive
Interesting.
because, again, it's a question of who's in the center. Is it me or is it Hashem? Now, what confuses the whole issue is that we do have a very real requirement to know our talents, to know what we're good at. That's not the same thing as asking, how do I feel and what do I feel? In other words, one of the ways that people, it's even in the Yom Yom, the Rebbe brought this, that to be bittul doesn't mean not to know what your talents are. Exactly the opposite. If you're going to be fulfilling your mission in life, if you're going to be fulfilling your role that Hashem put you here for, you have to know what you're good at. You can't go and do things that you have no talents for, that you have no ability for. So you have to know yourself in that sense.
Isn't the knowing thyself like that saying, and what people and knowing oneself on the deepest level, isn't that no, that is knowing God, no?
Again, I think it's mutually exclusive. That if you're going to be focusing on yourself in your meditation, then that's not isbonenus. Isbonenus always is focusing on Torah in some way, as a medium to eventually, when davening with the knowledge that I gained, and doing the isbonenus while I'm davening, to be able to connect to Hashem. There are also people who know how to meditate in a certain sense, maybe on Hashem Himself, but I think that's uncommon. I don't think we have any of those left in this generation. That would be like a prophet in a certain sense. The whole question all the time is, what is my mind? Since this is, again, this is meditation, not in the sense of calming the nervous system. This is meditation in the sense of filling the mind with something, or voiding the mind, which is what is more common in the East. How do I vacate my mind from any kind of thought? These things are very problematic, because if I fill my mind with myself, so that is my topic of investigation. To say that deep, deep somewhere inside I will find Hashem, that would be true if my topic of investigation would be my nefesh elokis. But that's not usually what people mean. What they mean is they want to understand their life, their problems, their issues, how they feel, especially how they feel. Those things don't really lead you anywhere closer to Hashem. Now, you asked a good question. Why is it that sometimes people go through this and they become closer to God, or at least they feel that they're closer to God, and they at least become closer to Yiddishkeit? I think that one of the things that even this type of investigation of the self uncovers is the terrible incompleteness of the self. That is one of the things that it tends to uncover. And there becomes a sense that I'm lacking in some way. I need something more. A lot of people go through life, they don't even understand that they're missing something. I think probably 60-70% of humanity still doesn't feel discontent is related to the fact that I'm not with God. They think that discontent is because I don't have this object or this salary or that honor or anything like that. They don't translate it that way. But I think that a lot of these meditations, they do get you to that point where you suddenly feel, wait a minute, it's not only about me. There's something inherently lacking about just focusing on myself. I need to have something more. Sometimes maybe it's even disgust with the self, in the sense that this self involvement is just too much. I need something else. I need something else to break out of. Sort of like if a person's, I don't know if you've ever binged watched anything, but if you have, I used to do it when I was in high school. I used to play the first version of Civilization. I could play it for like 2 days at a time, because wow. I was young. I was 14, 15. And I had that stamina. I had that ability. But when I finished like a 24-hour session, I was sick to my bones. I couldn't stand being that, only that all the time. And so I needed like a long break from it. And I think that in a certain sense, that's what these meditations give. They give you, again, not disgust because I'm disgusting, but because I can't, because I'm not infinite, really. I'm really finite, and it's like limiting myself. And this is all there is. This is all there is. It can't be. There must be something more. And so the person opens up, perhaps to the possibility that there's something beyond themselves. And that's maybe where the search for Hashem begins.
So when... Perhaps. When there's Like I mentioned earlier, when I, what ultimately led me to re-explore Hasidus, I get surrounded by different people at different events, and so, I keep in mind, maybe, on social media, whatever, just watching other people's things here and there. And there's a continuous interest and practice, let's say, of not just meditation retreats or even darkness retreats. People go spend 4 days, 10 days just in darkness. I don't know if you're familiar with that. What is that then healing or strengthening?
I would need to see something specific. I'm not sure exactly what it is strengthening or healing, but I know that all of the ones that I've encountered over my life, and I've encountered quite a number of them from, there was something that was very, very popular in the 70s that I got a whiff of when I, in the 80s, when I was in my teens. It was called EST, Erhard Seminars Training. That led to something that became very popular in Israel, which was called Mastery. And Mastery then was sort of taken over by, in the United States, by something called Call the Shofar. And all what they all had in common was one thing, that I could nakedly reveal myself before people and not feel embarrassed. And I don't mean physically naked. I mean bearing my soul, bearing my feelings, bearing my situation, all of that. And that feeling of exactly what Proverbs says, he wants to reveal himself. He wants to feel himself. But there's only so much I can feel myself in a room without people. If I can do it in front of people, I feel myself even more. Those things invariably lead to more ego. They don't allow a person to break out of that. I'm not saying to kill the ego, but you definitely can't make it stronger. You have to make it more resilient, but not stronger.
So can
so
a
I'm
person,
not sure what these new things are doing, if they're following the same thing, if it's the same type of, let me bare myself in front of you and show you everything that's inside, or whether it's doing something that's more classical.
More becoming more familiar with oneself, but that goes back to then what you're talking about before is, often we have, it's still just knowing maybe the talents or your how does a person distract himself? So you want to break through habits. So like if you're in a situation, I remember I did a silent retreat, for 10 days, years ago. And for 10 and a half hours a day, we're meditating. It was more so to become familiar with, because I'm getting out of routine. So I'm more so becoming familiar with, oh, wow, every time I have this type of thought, it leads to, this negative behavior. So, but it's.
All that is not the Shita of Hasidus, meaning.
Yeah. So Hasidus are you, so you're saying like, and did you learn that with Rabbi Ginsburg, that when a person takes, and you were talking, mentioning earlier, what are you using your mind on? If I'm practicing Hasbonanus on an idea of Hasidus or Torah, is that also going to have, because I'm taking attention off of the self, is that going to have that healing effect that people will go?
Oh, much more, much, much more. Because
can
I
you
started
dive into
with
that a little
effect,
bit?
Because all the problems start from my involvement with myself, with my ego. My ego is too strong. Again, we're not saying to kill the ego. You have to have a sense of healthy self in order to function in the world, but you can't be self-involved. And so the more it's sort of like, two things come to mind. One is a letter that somebody wrote to the Rebbe, and he asked him about, why do you keep saying that enlisting women in the army in Israel is such a terrible thing? I can understand that in normal circumstances, we wouldn't want women to be in the army, but under the present circumstances, which are so unique, when there's a fire, you have to put it out with whatever you can. So the Rebbe said, it's true. When there's a fire, you have to grab whatever you can and try to put out the fire, but you can't take a gasoline can and pour it on the fire. It's a liquid, but it's not going to serve the same purpose. So really what people are doing is they're saying, well, any type of meditation is going to work, but these meditations, the ones, especially the ones that come from the East, but not only, they focus on the ego. And what they're trying to do is strengthen the ego, make it more present and prevalent in everything that I do. Everything is about me.
Even though it looks like, even though it looks, let's take some of that.
It looks liquid.
Yeah, no, it looks like bittle. It looks like humility.
Right.
Let's say, like, I don't want to use names, but there are, you know, Boo Jews, you could say, that are very pop now, pop culture, that maybe had died in the past, and they actually were Jewish, but they were very well versed in this, and they have a pleasant aroma. What, not aroma? I don't know how they smell. A pleasant aura. They're very nice. They're very giving.
Why wouldn't you be?
Huh?
Why wouldn't you be? You're a Jew. That's their natural inclination. There's no reason to assume they were anything different before.
No, but also when I talk with, let's say, other the rabbis or mashpim about this, they often refer me to what happens to be one of my favorite, and the first mimer I learned, Biyom Ashtei Asar, where the Rebbe talks about, you know, the parable of a king comes with his duke and his prime minister, and the different people say, oh, I choose the duke, I choose the prime minister, I choose whatever, except for the one clever person says, I choose the king, because he's not subject to change. And then the Rebbe goes through talking how it is in Gashmias, in physicality, as well as Ruchnias and in spirituality. Do you think it's related to that? Like, they're just climbing a spiritual, like getting fascinated by...
Not only it's not exactly even that, because at least the Duke and the Viceroy or whatever they are, they're in the king's entourage. Here, it's an infatuation with the self. It has nothing to do with it.
Interesting.
The ego, there's a very simple statement in Tanya. It says that Adam Babeinonim, the regular person, is completely his nefesh bahamis. I'm not saying that you can't meditate on your nefesh locus. You can. That's exactly what Isbonenus is. I'm going to learn a shtickle of Chassidus, and I'm going to think about it for a long time. That's Isbonenus. I'm not thinking about it in thin air. I'm thinking about it the way that a human being thinks about it. So there I'm exercising my nefesh locus, because the subject matter is what the nefesh locus understands in. And even if I involve my nefesh bahamis, it's coming as a helper. It's coming as, okay, what do you know from the regular world that would fit into these constructs? But when the subject matter is me, so according to the Tanya, what I'm dealing with is my nefesh bahamis. That's what I'm meditating on. That's all I'm doing. Now, let me make it a little, you know, into a phrase, into something that's short and easy to remember. It says that Mashiach comes behesach hadas.
Mm-hmm.
Hesach hadas of what? Hesach hadas is always hesach hadas from something. The Mashiach comes when you have hesach hadas from yourself. That's the easiest explanation. It's mamish the pshat. The hesach hadas is, if I stop thinking about myself, there's a chance that Mashiach is going to appear in myself and others. That self-involvement is what gets us into all the trouble in the world. Everything starts from there. Depression starts from there. Any aspect of improper mental development, and then, God forbid, illness, whatever it is, starts from that feeding of the self as being so important. So now, people say, so what do you tell a child who just drew a beautiful picture? It's my favorite example, because I have some jokes about it. But what do you tell them? Well, I say, first of all, I can't say that it's beautiful. A, I'm not an art critic. I have no clue if it's beautiful or not. Secondly, I'm not a developmental psychologist. I don't even know what the child should be drawing at this age. Well, I know a little bit from my wife, but I really don't know. So saying that is both incredulous. And that's a huge problem with children. You should be very, very honest. You can't butter them up for no reason when there's no reason for it, except for the fact that you think that this is strengthening them. where in fact you're actually weakening them, because what they learn to expect from hard work, let's say they worked hard, is success. They're now looking at the work, they're looking at the result. And we know this from many, many places, that we're not promised results. Hashem even doesn't expect us necessarily to give results. He expects us to work. And we also, when we look at the world and we look at our lives, I hope I'm not tested with this, but like Reb Zusha said, Hashem never did anything terrible and bad to me. How could he say that? Because he never had any expectations of it being any different. He had no expectations. It said it had to be a rose garden. It had to be this. It had to be that. The understanding that life is about the work, it's not about the result, is what I need to impart on my children. So I need to praise their work, not the result. And if I'm,
I remember hearing a study that even showed that today too, that they compared the kids, how they responded based on if you tell them like you're so smart versus oh great effort, and they responded right. better with good effort.
I would say that from a Hasidic point of view, when you say how smart you are, you're only doing one thing: you're strengthening the animal soul.
Right. Wow,
self-infatuation,
mm-hmm.
and you're setting them up, because I was pretty smart in high school. I didn't have to work very much, and I finished pretty high in the class. And it's a public school, so it's a big deal there.
Mm-hmm.
When I got to college, it took me about one semester to figure out that I'm not that smart. And there's a lot of people who are a lot smarter than me. And that was like a wake-up call. So I took it relatively well, I think. Like I said, okay, I'm not smart. I'll go play soccer. I'll go do something else. And I always had this thing that I could fall back on Torah, and I was good at Shas and this and that. I'm not good at that either. But at the time, I thought it was. But some people completely break. They shatter when they have this realization, because they've been built up so much.
Identified, yeah.
Why do that to them? It doesn't even provide any encouragement. What you really want to encourage is the work. What you really want to encourage is the what is the true satisfaction from doing something? Because I'll say, the satisfaction is the simcha. If you enjoy what you're doing, you get the joy, that is the true satisfaction. Any other type of satisfaction that you look for is going to get you in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's all that Hashem gives in this world. Because there's no schar mitzvah in this world. It's not here yet. What is here? The joy out of doing a mitzvah. It's not the sahar. It's nothing. It's just the fact that I did what Hashem asked me to do. That is something that fills a person with joy. It gives meaning.
So if somebody, let's say, breaking through a habit, and part of the main reason actually I learned meditation was to, say, break a addiction to biting fingernails. Somebody else might have a other kind of addiction. And through the meditation I learned, you learn to become familiar by kind of rising beyond your normal thinking. You know, mm-hmm. there would be a form you get beyond your body, but get beyond the time and space, because now you're building a new routine of sitting down and meditating. And you become familiar with, okay, what's, just like we were talking about earlier with the pushing the buttons, or your wife has a reflection, what she says is a message to you. What's leading me to this behavior? And that would be, that seems like the secular meditation, but it also, like we talked about, can ultimately, the more and more you focus on yourself, you know, build the ego. So what would the Hasidic meditation approach be to this breaking, you know, breaking habits? Because we learn about it often in Hasidus. And I think you mentioned also towards the beginning, Rabbi Ginsburg mentioned that really it didn't seem to fulfill the promise, but how I understood it is that you meant the way that it's being taught, the way that we're educating it. So how would that be expressed? Let's say, you know, what should I still make the time, a person make the time to meditate and become familiar with, or just immerse more into what Torah and the Chassidus and Davenin? It may not be an either or, because often my questions are both and
When a person has a problem with the habit, so what you described is, let me take them up instead of the habitual, I'm going to take them up the intellectual. And the intellectual that you described is an intellectual that has to do with me again. It's like, again, analyzing what's driving me, what's going on. In and of itself, that's not so terrible. It's not like it's the end of the world. But when you think about, I need to take my mind off myself, that doesn't really serve that purpose. So what can I do? So I would say to someone, if you have, let's take the example that you brought, you have this thing with biting your nails. Two things. Well, first thing is, every time you catch yourself, for you, it's like an avera. And every avera has one purpose. It's a call from Hashem, come back to me. So biting your nails is not exactly an avera in the Torah, or Shulchan Aruch, anyway, and anything like that, but you feel that this is something that's detrimental to you. So it serves the same purpose. I have to go back to Hashem. So first of all, the first thing is, okay, I'm biting my nails now. What is that? That's like an avera for me. I've decided it's like an avera for me. So I have to call back to Hashem. I have to reconnect. That's what it's a sign for, meaning I'm using it, first of all, as a positive motivator to do something positive. It's a sign to. So that, first of all, is a tremendous change, because if it serves its purpose, I said it goes away. The moment that something has served its purpose completely, it will go away. And that's also true about bad habits that we have. If we can churn the bad habits into at least into something that calls me to something better, eventually I'll get to something better without the habit. I won't need it anymore. It's sort of like a crutch that I'm using for a while.
The means to
it. And it will resolve itself. Now, that's the first thing I would do. The second thing is, this is called achna. This is called submitting before Hashem, meaning that everything that's negative is not really negative for the sake of hurting me. It's negative for the sake of calling me back to Hashem. Then I have a second stage I call havdalah. This is from the Baal Shem Tov. Havdalah means literally separation.
So but what I would do is... This is in Svat HaRivash, right? Sounds familiar.
It's not Tzavas HaRivash for some reason. It's in Keser Shem Tov, though, 28. And then again, there's a few more places that he mentions this. The second stage of separation would be, go and learn, there's whole books on it, what the fingernails are. Why they are, by the way, they are the residue, in the same way the hair is the residue of the head, of the mind, the fingernails are the residue of the heart. So they're like residual emotions. In the same way that we say that the hair on top of my head is residual thoughts. That's the way the Kabbalah and Chassidus see these things. Go and learn about that and why it is that the tumah in the world clings to fingernails. That's Nagelvasser, right?
Yeah.
Why Nagelvasser? Because the tumah is on the whole body when a person sleeps. And when we wake up, it's enough for the first breath, the consciousness, to drive that tumah away. And it only continues to cling on the fingernails. And by the way, it clings on the fingernails of the feet also. But we're not Kohanim, so we don't have to wash both our hand nails and our toenails. We only do the top. But if you're a Kohen, before you start to work, you have to also wash your foot's nails, because that's where the tumah is also. And you have to think about it a little. Separation here is to see the holy side, meaning the Torah side of this whole issue. What am I actually doing? Try to understand, what am I actually doing from a Torah point of view? When these two things come in place, I find it that most of these habits disappear. Again, it's not like immediate success. It takes some time, but it's a different way of approaching it so that I don't have to focus on myself. I can focus on Hashem. I can focus on Torah. And eventually this whole thing shifts. And then it becomes something different. And that's the whole thing. The nails become what they're supposed to be.
Mm.
What are they supposed, what is involvement with the nails supposed to be even? Positively, what is it? Because it serves a positive purpose as well.
Yeah.
After the separation comes a state of sweetening. So what is the sweetening of the nails? So we see that in Avdala, we look at the nails, it must have a positive meaning.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that we have nails and that's it. There's a reason why Hashem gave us nails. So then you begin to say, wait a minute. Maybe, again, this needs thought for each person individually. But maybe my interest in my nails was all along because I have a need to recall Gan Eden. I need this in my life in some way.
Nice.
And so now looking at my nails, or I won't come and touch them because I already understand. I already went through that transition, but I look at them. And I, by the way, used to bite my nails until I think about age 19 or 20, don't know exactly when. And I sort of went through this process. I didn't know how to call it back then.
Yeah.
I didn't do it so naturally. I think somebody helped me, but it was something like this. And everybody will tell you, so, you know, the most important thing is to keep your mind off of it. Don't. But if you keep your mind off it, you do it absentmindedly. So there must be more to it than that. So eventually it became that I do look at my nails a few times a day. And now what I think about is Gan Eden. And I think of what does it mean that there's residue of emotions. What are these emotions? What are the residue?
Like residue meaning unresolved or?
No, like not necessarily. Yearning? It could be positive emotions. It could be negative. It could be very positive emotions.
Because the hands are like the emotional attributes.
They're the extension of the heart. Extension of the heart. And the nails are like the things that are left at the end. So it could be that it's from positive emotions. It could be from negative emotions. Ah, I have positive emotions. It's a good thing. It lifts me up to a different, that's what it means to be in Gan Eden. That's exactly, Gan Eden is a state in which all the emotions are in place. This famous thing from the Rebbe Moharash, that when he used to learn Eitz Chaim, he used to call it my Musar Seder. Why do you call it Musar Seder? Because all of Kabbalah, you could say, in a very simplistic fashion, and he explained this, said all of Kabbalah could be described as the fall of the emotional attributes from Chesed to Malchus. They're shattering and rebuilding them. What is that? That's Musar. That's taking my character. It broke down. It fell. And now I'm rebuilding it. When did it fall? When did that happen? When we ate from the tree of knowledge. Then where was the Shvira? Where was the shattering? From Das and down. All seven emotions were shattered. And what are we doing since then? We're rebuilding it.
Building it.
So a person looks at this, he can say, ah, I'm rebuilding. That's what I'm doing. This is the residue of my rebuilding. Nice. And it gives you a whole different perspective, even on your body. Your nice. Body is part of your Avodas Hashem.
Hmm. Teshuva of health. So what would you see if somebody, beginning to, you know, end this awesome interview, thank you again. What would you say if somebody's getting into, whether it's meditation or his bonus we talked about, what would be the barometer to know that it's a positive thing and not boosting your ego, but rather actually bringing you closer to alignment with Hashem? Could it be like halacha? You know, could halacha be the barometer?
Question about who's the world about?
Hmm.
It's just that question. Who's here in the center?
God, Hashem.
If it's still me in the center and it's all about me, so that hasn't helped. And the problem that I see in most of these, you know, the ones that go too far, is that people are really are really really hurt by them. They become so certain of their importance in this world that they can't tolerate anything. So in a certain sense, in the end, it's, can you feel that Gamzu Latoba? Can you really feel
everything is good?
Can you really, like Reb Zusha, can you say a blessing over the negative? Because there is no negative. It's all good. And again, it's not, you know, the Eastern systems, they reach that state that they call nirvana through detachment, not having any attachments. And Yiddishkeit is exactly the opposite. You need to marry. You need to have children. You need to have these attachments, which are painful sometimes, if not many times. You have to invest yourself in this physical world. And if, when you're invested in this physical world, you can still say Gamzu Latova with all the pain that you're enduring. I mean, there are incredible people now. I mean, this always happens when there are calamities. You hear these parents or spouses of children that are killed or murdered or fall in the army or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And you see how they attach to God and to faith. And some people will say, oh, they're in some kind of denial. They're not in denial at all. They have elevated to this level of understanding that even though I'm very attached, through my attachments is where I come to know Hashem.
But there seems to be a little bit of a distinction as well, because we're talking also that this type of attachment Judaism is talking about also includes, let's say, Torah and mitzvah. So somebody can get into, let's say, the secular meditations or whatever that we're talking about and be very involved in the world and doing a lot of positive things, but not involved with Torah and mitzvahs.
Okay. I mean, I don't know if that's entirely true, because I don't know if people come out of these retreats or whatever, and the first thing they go do is a shidduch. Like the first thing they understand, oh, you know, I'm not a whole person.
Yeah.
Is that the understanding that people get, or do they come out and say, oh, I feel pretty good about myself. I could go on like this for a long time.
Well, it depends. I mean, it's more so you come to a place of acceptance, I would think, and wholeness of your half, but you still have, I mean, I can't speak for other people, but like I at least I felt that obviously I still want a wife, because that's the other half of my soul, but in order to attract that other individual, that other half, it's also being in a place of wholeness. Not like we were talking about Hezekiah Dax. Like similarly, I think, you know, my wife will come when I'm not looking for her. Like, where is my wife? Where is she? But when I'm actually, you know, just focused in what I'm doing, and then all of a sudden somebody says, hey, I have this idea for you.
So if I would, you know, forgive me for analyzing what you just said.
Please.
I said, I want a wife. And it has to come, and I have to be whole.
This was back then.
I'll tell you that, because people tell you that. You should be a whole person in order to be, and I would tell you exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. The time that you're ready to get married is when you want to start investing in others. Not that you're whole. You're never whole. You'll never be complete. As one of the beautiful symbols that we have is that in the kiddushin, or before the, or the rather the shiduchim, you could call it, when you sign the first document, which is not the ketubah, but before that you have this erusin type of thing.
Yeah,
not exactly erusin, because it's not Chabad. We do it at the wedding, so the two mothers break a plate.
Mm-hmm.
What's that saying? It's saying that I'm half a person. That's the symbolism there. You can't get married if you think you're whole. You have to get married out of a place of understanding that you're not whole. Not whole, not whole in the sense of you're not a person. You don't have a self. You have to have identity. You have to know who you are. But you have to have a feeling that I need someone else to complete me, because I am not a complete person. So sometimes we have this concept from Rav Ginsburg. We don't have time now, but it's called the hole and a half. That's for a different conversation. But it's not that I want, it's that Hashem commands me. That has to be the outlook. The moment that you come from the fact that Hashem commands me, I guarantee you will be married within 2 months. There's no question in the world. Because if Hashem, you want me to.
We're going to be in touch.
You have all the power in the world to make this happen. So make it happen.
Wow. I think we'll end there. Thank you very much, Rabbi, for coming on. And
pleasure seeing you again.
All this time. I'll keep you in touch. I think I have to think about that. And maybe I'll be married in 2 months. Me too, Shem.
Go to.